You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
My girlfriend sucked 37 dicks.
In a row?
Hey, buddy, you gonna eat that sausage?
No, go past this. Past this part. In fact, never play this again.
Tell me something, my friend.
Am I the only one around here who gives a shit about the role?
Ladies and gentlemen!
Your complete attention, if you please.
The Epic Film Guys Podcast. Welcome, one and all, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another Epic Film Guys live stream event. We're doing a spotlight tonight, Dan, Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island, 2010, a film starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Mark Ruffalo, Max von Sydow popping up in this, Sir Ben Kingsley, the Mandarin himself, quote unquote. No, sorry.
I still contend that is my favorite thing ever that fanboys have cried about.
was it
all ham-fisted and stupid at the end? Sure.
Oh yeah.
But was it actually kind of hilarious to see a guy just be an actor instead of an actual villain? Yes, that is fucking hilarious.
LOL. Pour my beer here. Jesus, they filled this thing full.
Did you talk about Michelle Williams? You mentioned her.
And Michelle Williams.
There we go, Michelle Williams. Incidentally, Michelle Williams and Mark Ruffalo's first roles that I ever saw them in.
And really?
Didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah. Really?
I never saw anything. I hadn't seen Zodiac at this point. I got to remember when I saw The Kids Are All Right, because that was the first Mark Ruffalo role. I think it's the first time I knew he was Mark Ruffalo.
That
I didn't know he was Mark Ruffalo
movie.
At the time.
I remember. That was Annette Bening and Julianne Moore, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, where they play the
lesbian
couple.
And of course, as is tradition, Julianne Moore is an R-rated movie, so she had to be fucking naked.
Hashtag truth. yeah, we are here. We're here to discuss Shutter Island, as we talked about before. We should warn from the outset, and we'll probably drop a couple more warnings as we go through in case people drop into the stream or out of it or whatever, that we will be spoiling the ever-loving hell out of this film. This film was released back in 2010, so if you haven't seen it yet, close the stream, go watch it, and then come back and watch the replay
or stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast. Yeah. Whatever the case may be. Or if you just happen to wander in here because I don't even know why you would wander in here. For this, who knows? But anyway, welcome. We're going to be giving away some stream prizes tonight, Dan. Are you excited for stream prizes? I'm excited for stream prizes.
I'm upset that I'm not going to be able to win stream prizes. It looks like my only competition will be Loisos.
We've already sent you so much shit.
I want more, goddammit. I still haven't worn the shirt you sent me.
Really?
I haven't. Wow. I mean, I washed it. I haven't put it. Like, I have so many black shirts, it's ridiculous. So, like, I just run down the rotation of black shirts, and eventually I'll get to it.
Nice. All right, well, but every week on the main show, Dan, we like to do a little something where we talk about the alcohol that we are funneling into our fuck holes or slamming into our sissy holes or whatever you want to call it. It's called, What Are You Drinking?
I'm back! Puke and rally! Yeah. Woo!
And as the guest on the stream tonight, first of all, thank you very, very much for being here. Now, we were supposed to be joined also by Gerald from Two Peas on a Pod. Unfortunately, he could not work it out with his schedule, but don't worry, we're going to get Gerald on another stream at some point in the future. Gerald, we love you. We wish you were here. But Dan, why don't you let us know what you are belching into your bick hole? No, never. I don't.
Don't say that. That's gross. That's really gross. That's fucking disgusting.
How are you? What do you got? What are you drinking?
All right. I'm drinking the Old Hickory Brewing Company's Lindley Park Stout American Imperial Double Stout. I don't know. There's a lot of shit. There's a lot of shit on this Untappd report. I checked it into Untappd to make sure I had all the relevant taste statistics, such as 10% alcohol by volume and 50 IBUs. the only way you can tell how a beer tastes. but as I said, it is a bourbon barrel aged stout.
Nice.
It's fine. I'm not too impressed with this. There's not a lot of with my bourbon barrel aged stouts. I prefer like a lot of bourbon taste to it, and there's just not a lot here. Honestly, it's very faint, and otherwise the stout is just fine. I like the stout portion of it. I just wish there was more bourbon to it.
Yeah, so it's like, no Dragon's Milk, is what you're saying.
No, it's nothing like Dragon's Milk. Yeah. Dragon's Milk is the number one.
It's hard when Dragon's Milk is literally the top of that mountain that you're trying to climb to really get up there so you can try to make a dent in it.
Yeah. So I'll ask you, what are you drinking?
What's up, my Nubian friend?
Wayne, get out of here. How do you
I
get
said that
here?
To Caleb in a chat with Paul. And I said, what's up, my Nubian friend? And Caleb's like, what's a Nubian? And I'm like, I define it as of or relating to Nubia. Just being a dick.
I mean, it's the something from Star Wars Episode 1 as well. There's a...
Is it really?
Yeah. It's the
that sounds
it's
like something. It sounds like something
cruiser.
George...
Like, that's the kind of ship they have? I don't know. I really don't think that that's sounds the context like something George Lucas would write it, but...
No, that's definitely not. He's saying they are of the darker skin.
Right. All right. Well, I made my way out to Upstate Brewing in Elmira, one of my favorite local breweries, local-ish. It's like a 45-minute to an hour drive away from here. But they did a release, Dan, for their 2018 ale in cans. It's by far one of the most amazing beers continually that I've ever had. You're welcome. And that's not what I'm drinking right now, though, even though I bought an entire case of it for an amount of money I will not divulge here on the stream. But I also picked up another beer while I was there. What I have is the Cannonball Milk Chocolate Stout. And ooh. I actually checked this in on Untappd when I had it at Upstate earlier, and I referred to it as, quite simply, the perfect chocolate stout. This is not the chocolate stout that Caleb had on our Nolan Megasode, where he bought Miller Lite and poured it into Walmart brand chocolate ice cream. No, this is fantastic. You get light, kind of dark roasted malts and light coffee flavor. You get a nice kind of sweet chocolate flavor that brings up the back end of this thing. It's fantastic. I can't begin to tell you how much I love this beer. I only bought a half of a growler of it, and I'm going to kick it tonight while we're on the stream. So
nice.
Cheers to you, Dan, and thank you very much for showing up for the live stream where we are talking again all about Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island. Again, came out in 2010, Dan, and why don't you give us like a brief synopsis of what the film's all about?
So U.S. Marshal Teddy Daniels is sent off to this island. Kind of penitentiary, kind of home for the criminally insane, in order to find a lost or missing or escaped patient from one of the wings. While he is there, he also researches upon a 67th mysterious prisoner to this island.
All right. Well, again, as I mentioned earlier, Leonardo DiCaprio, Michelle Williams, Sir Ben Kingsley, Mark Ruffalo,
get that sir in there.
Max von Sydow floating around in this thing. And Jackie Earle Haley is in this. And I love Jackie Earle Haley. Of course, he was Rorschach in Watchmen. So like I said earlier, we're going to be spoiling the hell out of this movie. So if you haven't seen this film, you need to check it out because I really enjoy this film. And Dan, I'm guessing you're on the show because you really enjoy this film. So
no, this is going to be the lost episode where Dan bitches about Shutter Island the whole time.
God damn it. But yeah, like, I guess we could start things off maybe in terms of talking performances. We can really talk about the twist in the film, as mm-hmm. it were. And I'm going to talk about that and how it relates to kind of the performances in the film a little bit later. But first things first, why don't we kick it off with Leonardo DiCaprio, the man himself. How'd you feel about him in this?
I feel like he was good. This isn't like one of those like big time Leo performances that I think about. I like him a bit more in Inception. You know, I haven't watched Leo in like a ton of movies. I think I really got into Leo around Inception, and then this came out, and I also like I enjoyed this, and then you know you got to The Revenant and all that stuff. So I like Leo in this movie. It's just this isn't his best. Like he doesn't really do much of anything until the last 30 20 minutes, something like that, where, you know, the big reveal happens.
Yeah. And there is kind of that whole element to it where there's a big twist that's going to be coming in the film, and it kind of changes your perception of things, especially after you've watched it a couple of times and you start to really pick up on a lot of subtle things, which is nice. But I love him in this. I'm actually going to disagree with you. I think this is one of his better performances. I think that it's not quite as showy as some of his other performances. It's almost a little bit quieter, if you can imagine that,
sure,
for Leonardo DiCaprio performance. But I think that this is a little bit more effective. I think when he has the more emotional moments, I really feel more invested in his character in this versus, say, you know, like some films like, well, you mentioned Inception. I think he's great in that as well. But even more recent films like The Revenant, where he won his Oscar, but he didn't really win it for that. We all know
Don't give me that shit. He was, I have a lot of things to complain about with The Revenant and it, him winning for that specific movie.
He won because of his body of work. He did not win for that movie.
That is 100%
plain
correct
and simple. But yeah, I actually like this performance. Like I said, it's a little bit quieter. Like I said, if you can imagine that from Leo, because he's a pretty intense actor in a lot of his performances. But even when he turns it on, even when he has that kind of emotionality to him, there's a lot of layers to his character where you can't really tell exactly what's going on with him. He carries a lot of demons in this film. He was president at the liberation of the Dachau concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
So he carries that with him. His wife died when the home was burned down. Yep. And that's also kind of another element of this film where he's on the film looking for this Andrew Latus character, who is the person who lit the match, as he says, that burned down the house. So there's a lot of kind of packaging wrapped around this thing. And when you first meet him in the film, he's bent over a toilet on a boat. I love that about it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, it's kind of like, not to keep referencing Inception here, but it's kind of like Inception where you kind of just get dropped in the middle of this thing. You don't see this character, you know, get assigned this case. You don't get any real background to this character outside of, you know, he's just on this ship and then you kind of learn about him through the island. There's no like him at this agency. There's no him in like some federal office. It's just him. And I can't remember what Mark Ruffalo's character's name is in this movie. However, it's just those two on a boat and they're going to this island to find some escaped prisoner. And, you know, you start to learn about these characters throughout the entire film.
Yeah. And speaking of Mark Ruffalo, and the name of his character is Chuck Ayole, something like that. A-U-L-E.
Chuck Ayole.
Yeah. Chuck Ayole. But yeah, and
that
he's his partner,
disgusting.
And he has this kind of quirky thing where he always calls him boss.
Yeah.
Which is like, yeah, if in terms of like character quirks and stuff like that, like it's one of those things where, and this is where, again, we're going to start tipping our hat more and more and more toward the big reveal, the big twist in the film. But it almost feels as if it's a forced kind of camaraderie. Like almost a visit, like a forced familiarity, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of feels almost a little bit disingenuous. But what did you think of Ruffalo in the film?
I liked Ruffalo. You know, as you say, it's kind of like this forced camaraderie. It's like how if you walk up to a party and like you walk up to some other guy in a party and you're just like, "Hey, what's up, bro? Hey, what's up, dude? Hey, what's up, man?"
Yeah,
like you're kind of trying to force like this friendship that, you know, it's just some stranger you've never met before. And, you know, this is your first case assigned. So I like that about his character. And I guess it makes sense. You know, he's very much background. Like he just kind of lets Teddy lead the investigation. You know, he isn't like he never really kind of puts forth this idea of like, hey, let's go do this. It's always, hey, Teddy, what do you think we should do here? Like what's the next move?
Yeah, very much placing the ball in his court. And I mean, again, we'll get there. But to kind of go through the rest of the cast, anybody else in the cast that you really felt was kind of a standout? Ben Kingsley's one for me. I love Ben Kingsley and pretty much anything he does. He's a fantastic actor to watch just because he is always very varied in his performances. And I really, really love him in this as well. And anybody else that you really can point out from the cast that you really loved?
Someone who I think got underused was Ted Levine, for instance. Like, you only get him in like two scenes, and one scene is them just being like, oh, look, it's the warden. And the other time when he drives them back, when he drives Teddy back to the main part of the island. I would have liked to see more of Ted Levine. You know, obviously he is Buffalo. What is it? Buffalo Bill? Is that who I'm thinking? Is that his character in Silence of the Lambs?
I cannot remember.
Whoever the serial killer is in Silence of the Lambs, I can't recall it this time. And also his role as Captain Stottlemyre in Monk. I'm very familiar with Ted Levine's career, but I feel like he was kind of underused in this movie.
Somebody else who I think was peppered in, you only get like little bits and pieces of her here and there, but that was Michelle Williams as Dolores. You only get her in flashbacks in the film because she's, of course, Teddy's wife, and she is dead at the start of the story. But man, Williams always brings her A game to pretty much any performance that she does, and that's no different here. She 100% sells everything about this character from the moment you first see her. So, man, I loved her as well. I thought she was fantastic. I thought Jackie Earle Haley was fantastic as George.
Yeah.
And
he had one scene, but he pretty much stole it.
Yeah,
ran away. For whatever reason, Jackie Earle Haley can really portray that kind of guy that's, seems not all together there, but like is mostly there, but just he's just not. There's just like that little part of him that hinges off a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I want to get into especially things like the setting of this film on the island, because the island itself is really another character in this film. It's a very kind of intense, foreboding place. I love how atmospheric it is. Scorsese shoots the ever-loving hell out of that island, and I think it's absolutely beautiful. Any thoughts on that?
Well, the setting, and this kind of gets contrasted with these flashbacks that Teddy has throughout the entire movie, but everything is kind of washed out. Like, this is a very bleak island. There's not a lot of hope here, You run into the off-inmate that, seems to, kind of like how Jackie Earle Haley's character exists. They kind of have like they seem almost all the way there, but there's just that little piece of them that like tips off and like can just knock the whole boat over for them, so like there isn't a lot of hope here for a lot of these prisoners, because it's just like, well, you're all just apparently criminally insane. Like, there's no hope for you to get off this island. You will die here, and it just feels like that the entire way through.
Yeah, it feels it. You're right. It's a very, very bleak kind of place. It really is paired quite well, I think, with the images of the Dachau concentration camp, where obviously Leonardo DiCaprio, this is set in 1954. So he obviously was in the army during the war. And then when he got out of the army, he became a U.S. Marshal. But I mean, obviously, if you see something like that, it's going to stick with you for the rest of your life. So it really haunts him. It really, really kind of follows him, and it's a perfect mirror to the conditions that he's seeing there, because it's dingy, it's dirty, it's disgusting. And you see a lot of these patients there that really, I mean, especially when you kind of compare them side by side with a lot of the prisoners in the concentration camp, also look very similar. So I thought that was a fantastic, fantastic kind of comparison that Scorsese does there.
To a degree, I would say more with the Ward C criminals, definitely. However,
it's very prominent once it gets to Ward C.
Yeah, but like it seems like with Wards A and B, it's like, okay, these people probably aren't going to harm anybody else, or they're just too mentally incapable to harm anybody else.
They're a little more normalized. So
we can kind of let them roam around and we can kind of let them roam around and kind of like have some semblance of a normal life.
Yeah. Trying to think. I just finished rewatching the film, so I'm trying to think of all the different.
Well, I wanted to kind of talk about the dream sequences and how they're kind of more vibrant in color. Like the color isn't as nearly as drab as the rest of the movie. Like, for instance, like when we have the first, I'll call it nightmare sequence for Teddy, when he dreams back to his wife in the apartment, she has this bright yellow dress, and it just sticks out in the movie to me because you're not seeing yellows. You're seeing whites, blues, grays, browns, blacks. Like, this isn't a very colorful movie. Like, there's no real vibrancy to the movie until you get to this dream sequence, and you get this bright yellow dress that just sticks in your mind, and you can really understand why the Teddy character always just thinks of this yellow dress.
And the funny kind of thing about it is, not just the flashbacks, including his wife, but also the flashbacks to the concentration camp are very colorful, especially in the blood. The Nazi officer who's lying on the floor, and the blood is exceedingly bright and vibrant. Like, it definitely stands out contrasted to everything that's around it. And you get to see that later on when you get to see kind of the flashback to how his wife died. The blood is, again, just very, very vibrant. But you're exactly right. It does stand out a lot. It's a very, very sharp contrast to what you're getting in this real world. And I mean, I guess to touch on what we're going to find out later about Teddy, I really think that this kind of represents, you know, the Teddy that was. I think this really kind of represents the Teddy as he was before all these terrible things happened to him, and before obviously he ended up on this island investigating this case, you know?
Well, like you say, it's like there was more vibrance, there was more enthusiasm to his life, let's say, before his wife died. And now he's on this island, and there's just nothing but bleakness. You know, his wife is dead. He's stuck on this island for X number of days. It's just there isn't a lot of hope for this Teddy character at all.
Yeah, there's really not. And to touch on something else, and Dan, just plug your ears for just a moment, but I also really, really love the score in this film. There's a lot of classical pieces in this film. Krzysztof Penderecki is one, and he's a Polish composer, and it's important because that music, it's kind of what triggers one of the first flashbacks that Leo's character has, because it was also playing in the officers' quarters at Dachau when he liberated the concentration camp. So it kind of takes him back to that. And then I also mentioned this to you, and when you returned to me, there's a score that's a piece that I absolutely love. It's a hauntingly beautiful piece. It's called On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter. Also used extremely effectively by Denis Villeneuve in Arrival 2 years ago.
Where is it in Arrival?
It's like right at the beginning and right at the end.
Well, that makes sense, you know, with Arrival.
Dan, there was a score in Arrival too.
there was a score? There's music in movies?
I love you. Yeah, I love the score.
You're gonna hate me. The only time I notice music in movies is like during the Fast and the Furious movies. And I'm just like, oh, this is a very Latino feel song. I guess they're in some Latino area.
Gerald, welcome to the live stream. Hey, like we said, man, we'll get you on another spotlight. Nothing to worry about. Unfortunately, life happens. And I'm glad Gerald didn't catch all the parts earlier in the stream where we were bashing the shit out of him, saying we hoped he died and everything. I'm glad he didn't hear any of those, because that would have been...
Yeah, I'd rather have Andy on this live stream.
And where's Andy? Where's the other P in the pod? Damn it. Oh, but to get back to this film, another thing that I really, really love about this film is the Easter eggs. And I guess we can talk about it as we segue into the big reveal that we talk about, Dan, is the Easter eggs to what's really going on. And one of those Easter eggs is water and wetness. If you remember that first flashback with his wife, when it ends, like, everything falls to ash and everything's kind of burning away, but all of a sudden his wife is soaking wet, and then like his hands are just like full of water, and there's like a puddle of water at his feet, even though she like burns away into ash. There's a lot of other great Easter eggs in this film, and I know when we were talking earlier, you mentioned a couple of them to me. What were some of your favorites rewatching the film?
My favorite is, without a doubt, when they're interviewing patients about... I'm spacing on the escape patient's name at this moment, but...
It's Rachel Solando.
Rachel Solando. When they're interviewing patients about Rachel Solando, and the one woman comments about how... not attractive, but the quote is, he's not too hard on the eyes about this one doctor. And it cuts over to Mark Ruffalo, and he kind of gives her this look, and she kind of gives him this look back, and you're just like, man, that's a really weird shot. Why would you?
Yep.
What is that?
And that's also a fantastic scene.
Fuck you,
scene.
Ashley. That's a good joke.
It's also a fantastic scene because during that same interview, when he's interviewing that patient, he asks her if he knows who Latus is. And in her reaction, like, she doesn't say anything to him right away anyway, but she immediately becomes emotional. You can tell it's a wonderful performance by the actress in that role who, yeah. You know, her eyes well up with tears. And I mean, it's clearly, you know, she's clearly very, very sad. And then she immediately just kind of rushes to the end of the conversation and says, no, I've never heard of him. And then gets up and leaves the interview.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's fantastic. Mark Ruffalo, and this is one thing that I noticed rewatching the film. It's not something you really notice or pay any attention to the first time through, but man, yep. Does he lob a lot of softballs at DiCaprio's character.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
It's insane. It's insane rewatching this movie and just being like, oh my God, I never knew. Like, cause when I first watched this, I had no idea about the book. I actually watched this with somebody who had read the book. And, you know, of course, afterwards they were like, man, the book was better. And I'm just like, I don't care. This movie was awesome. Like like everything about this movie was great. And, you know, you just don't catch the little thing. Like there's things that you're like, that was a really weird shot. Why did they do that? And then at the end of the movie, you're like, oh my God, everything makes sense now. Like this is just brilliant storytelling through what if you were critiquing this movie as it went along, it would be like, man, that's a really weird shot. Why they do that? Man, this is a really weird shot. Why they do that? Holy shit! I now understand everything. Like it's that kind of movie.
Yeah, and it's all directed. Scorsese's a master for a reason, and it's expertly directed by Scorsese, where he peppers enough of this stuff in here to really hints at the true nature of the film and really hints at exactly what's going on in the film without overtly stating it, without really giving you much cause to, you know, question things. Like, you're kind of following these episodes and you know that he's having migraines, Leo's character, that is, you know, he's having migraines, you know, he's having these weird visions and nightmares and stuff like that. So you're kind of starting to question things. And then with the plot elements that they pepper into this, because at one point in the film, he climbs down a cliff and he meets Dr. Rachel Solando, who explains that she was actually a doctor there and that, you know, they're testing things on patients, they're drugging patients, they're performing lobotomies and surgeries and things of that nature, which obviously is sensitive for Teddy because he was in the war. He liberated a concentration camp. He saw it.
Right.
So it's obviously very, very hard for him to see. But then, you know, as you kind of start to piece these little things together, these little fragments together, and all right, let me say this before we get further into it, whether or not you teased out the twist in this film early on in the first viewing of it, you figured it out right away. Good job. That's fine. But I will say, rewatching the film and knowing the twist, this film's a lot more tragic. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you felt the same way, Dan, but this film plays out like a really, really sad and really tragic story. It's heartbreaking watching this film the second time through. It really, really is.
Well, it is, because you're getting this character who has, like, his world in 1952 shatters. And it's fragments off and creates this second person who is everything that this Teddy person is everything that the man was prior to his earth shattering. And then everything else has been compartmentalized into this little ball that you don't want to go back to. And, you know, in this film, it's all about finding out that little ball that you don't want to go back to and revisiting it because you have to confront it. You can't ignore it any longer. It's a part of you. You have to confront this as yourself, as a whole. You can't be fractured anymore. You must, as a whole, confront what happened to you and accept it and deal with it and move on from it.
And I agree with you over there, Gerald, in the live stream, Michelle Williams' life. I've loved Michelle Williams since The Creek. I absolutely love her. I think she's a phenomenal actress. And as she's aged, she only gets better.
As in Dawson's?
As in Dawson's Creek, yeah. I watched the shit out of that show, like, when it was on the air.
Oh, I know, I know. That's what I assumed you meant by the creek.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was like, she's just gotten better. I've never heard of this creek movie.
She's just gotten so much better as she's gotten through her career. She was in Manchester by the Sea last year. Fantastic in that, even though, again, same thing with kind of this movie, really small role. It wasn't like a huge, huge role or anything for her.
Yeah.
But she's fantastic in this film. And I love the way that this film kind of evolves the more times you watch it into a more and more tragic film. Now, Loisaw said something over when I posted this on Facebook earlier that I was watching it for a spotlight. He said it's Scorsese's worst film. Which, I don't want to get into a debate over Scorsese's filmography here, but it's clear that he probably didn't really enjoy the film too much. Mm-hmm. And it's because of a scene that happens at the lighthouse toward the end of the film where, ba-bam, the film drops the hammer on you and gives you the big reveal. Teddy's not real. Teddy doesn't exist. And Andrew Laidis is Leonardo DiCaprio. His wife, there is no Rachel Solando. His wife is Dolores. And she's Rachel. These are anagrams of their two names, Teddy Daniels and Rachel Solando. Mm-hmm. And it was his wife that drowned their kids. And as recompense for this, he ends up killing her and then gets institutionalized.
Yeah.
So when you learn the big twist in the film, I mean, it has this whole scene where they are trying so hard to break through to him. And then when you rewatch this film, Dan, it's evident to me, like when Mark Ruffalo, when he's lobbing those softballs over the plate, they're just, all these softballs are, is they're just trying to get him to pinch one of them. They're trying to get him to take a swing at one of them to bring him back to reality, because he's such a dangerous prisoner and he's trapped so deeply into his own psychosis. They're trying anything they can to reach him. And it ends up being that this entire film is this huge, you know, kind of psychotherapy experiment to try to break through to him, to break him from this kind of crazy conspiracy theory that he's concocted in his head, this whole alternative reality, to not deal with the fact that he kills his wife after she drowns their kids. And I mean, first of all, because you and I haven't talked about this aspect of it, the first time you ever watched this film, which I don't know when it was, but the first time you ever watched this film.
Oh, it was in theaters. This was like the movie came out, I watched this in theaters.
Yeah, I love it. I actually really, really enjoy the twist of it. But what did you think of the twist when you first watched the film?
It's almost like an anticlimax. You know, it's building and building and building and building. Like, you get to, and you finally get to the lighthouse, and he knocks out this guard, and you're just like, huh, that's really strange that they have one guard just watching this lighthouse when all these, like, horrific experiments are happening. And then as he's going through the lighthouse, and he's checking these rooms, and they're all empty, and they're all empty. And then you're like, all right, he's reached the top. This is clearly where everything happens. And then you kick in the, and then he kicks in the door, and then there's only Ben Kingsley just sitting there. And you're just like, what the fuck is happening right now? What am I watching? Yeah.
And I think, to me, I mean, the twist isn't why I enjoy this film. And I mentioned over there on Facebook when I was talking about it earlier that the twist isn't the reason why I enjoy this film. And I enjoyed this film again, knowing the twist. I think that this is one of those films where the twist, I mean, fine, it is what it is. It's a twist. It's great. Whatever. Who cares? But I think that this film plays out even better because the entire film, when you go back and rewatch it, knowing that Teddy Daniels is Andrew Laidis, when you go back knowing that his wife is Rachel Solando, it becomes this really, really tragic film of them all desperately trying to reach this character. Their compassion and their caring for this character, I really felt it this time through when I watched it, because they don't want to have to lobotomize him. And unfortunately, that's where they're going. Unfortunately, Kingsley's character tells him, he says, if we can't get through to you this time, if you don't have a breakthrough, and if these episodes don't stop, they're going to lobotomize you. And then he's basically just going to be catatonic. And, you know, it's no quality of life. He's going to lose everything. You know,
I feel like with saying that, you're kind of handing Andrew Laidis a double-edged sword. You're like, all right, fucking figure it out, or we're going to lobotomize you. And it's like, okay, well, if I bring this sword back to me, I lobotomize myself. But if I push it forward, I have to accept everything that's happened to me. And I don't know, as a person personally, if I would be able to accept the fact that, you know, my wife drowned my three children and then I murdered her. I don't know, like, if my psyche wouldn't wind up just like this person. So it's just like,
yeah.
You almost kind of want everything the conspiracy has been to be true. You want everything you've heard from the fake Rachel Solando, who was played by Patricia Clarkson, which I appreciate Scorsese doing this, where he uses, I think her name is Emily Mortimer. He uses Emily Mortimer, and then they kind of facsimile her with Patricia Clarkson to create this person that kind of looks, they kind of look enough, like, similar enough to where it's like, okay, yeah, I can see this. And it's like, they kind of splinter it off into like, okay, which one do you believe actually exists? And the Patricia Clarkson version, you know, continues with this conspiracy theory and, you know, makes you want to disbelieve everything they're telling you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just like, but, and they keep having to hammer him. Mark Ruffalo and Ben Kingsley just have to hammer him. You are Andrew Latus. There is no random guy who did maintenance in your apartment. You are him. You need to take responsibility. You need to understand who you are. And you need to figure that out. You need to unfracture yourself. You need to become whole once again and move on.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think that this plays out so, so tragically when you think about watching through it again, knowing the twist, and kind of as you walk through it, I agree with you 100%. When you're watching it, and once you find out the twist, you're kind of like, take it back. You're kind of like, no, you wish the conspiracy was true, because yeah, like, really. And Kingsley even tells him, he's like, we've had a breakthrough once before 9 months ago, and then you regressed, you know, and this is it. And it hangs this curtain of doom over the rest of the film the first time you watch it. But then when you rewatch it, knowing that, that curtain of doom is there the entire time. And it just becomes this really, really tragic film about a lot of people, a huge, huge group of people who are desperate to save him. I mean, when you think back to the one patient when they were interviewing, when she becomes emotional, like, all these people clearly know what's going to happen if he can't break out of this. If he can't break free from this, everybody knows where he's going and what's going to happen to him. So my question to you then is, Should they have even tried the twist? Would it have been better if they would have just kind of presented this character and presented his past and then, you know, put him into the hospital and then, you know, they're trying to save him. And then unfortunately are unable to. It still could end the same way. It still could end with the tragic ending. But would you kind of unfold the layers of the film to take the twist away from it? Does that make a better film, or does that make the film worse?
You kind of have to do it this way, because this is the life he used to live. So you kind of want to remind him of how he was before the incident with his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to be like, look, you were an upstanding person. You work with the government. You were the army. We need you to remember all of that. We need you to remember all that. And we need you to go through this, and we need you to kind of process it on your own terms. We can't just kind of like, I feel like you can't force something on people. So
true.
You kind of have to let them. And unfortunately, the ending of the movie, they still kind of are forcing it on him, because he just refuses to, like, for instance, they hand him, Mark Ruffalo has this piece of paper that describes the 67th patient. Yep. It's Andrew Latus. And he hands it to him and he's like, you need to read this. And he's just like, no, 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 let's get to that fucking lighthouse. And, you know, Ben Kingsley takes out a copy of this page. And he's like, this is what you were missing. This, we really felt like you needed to read this. And that's why we kept, like, kind of beating it over your head with Mark Ruffalo. Yeah. He's been like, read this. You know, you need to read this. And, you know, so, like, I guess at the end they kind of have to beat it into his head, because, you know, he's just not taking the whole role playing. He's still. And I feel like the kind of role play kind of backfires on them, where he just doesn't want to understand what actually happened to him. He's just trapped in this part of his mind before the whole incident happens, where he's just he just is a marshal, and his wife died in a fire, and he's here to investigate a missing patient, and that's it, you know?
Well, I'll take it even one step further than that to kind of go back to what you were talking about before. When you see the flashbacks and you see those pops of color, you know what those pops of color also represent? They represent life, and they represent his life, and they represent this kind of idyllic life that he used to have. And that's broken for him. That's gone. That's been ripped away and destroyed. And, you know, he's running through this whole thing. And when they present him with the truth, when they present him ultimately with who he is and what happened, I mean, really, you know, I just don't think he's ever able to really escape from that. And I don't think he wants to. I think that there's numerous times in the film when he has flashbacks, when they're telling him, you have to let her go, you have to forget her, you have to move on from your wife, you have to do this. And he continually becomes insanely emotional, and he can't he can't do it. And I don't think he wants to. I think he'd rather be there with her. And I just, on his part, for his character, when you get through all of it, when you get to the end of the day, when all is said and done, I don't think that he necessarily cares to make that breakthrough. I think he'd rather regress and kind of remember his wife the way that he wants to, as opposed to remembering this kind of monster that he became and this monstrous act that he perpetrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, as they say, it turns out that his wife is the one who burned down their family home, and it's the reason they went to this lake house. And then she drowns the kids, and it's like, well, he doesn't, like, he feels like he's a monster because he didn't get her help. Like, he feels like he's responsible because he didn't get her help. And that's really what, like, the whole compartmentalization is because. Like that's the reason why he compartmentalizes, is because he feels responsible because he just didn't get his wife help. He didn't see the signs, if for whatever reason, you know, your wife burning down your house, at some point you're just like, well, maybe you should see somebody or something, maybe. But he just didn't do that. So, and now he feels responsible for the death of his three children. So it's just like, I can't deal with that. Like, he just becomes a white girl. He can't even, and just fragments that part of his brain off into a part where,
pumpkin,
you know,
spice latte from Starbucks.
Exactly. But, you know, really, this is all what this movie comes down to is mental health. Yeah. Like, this is, you know, like, Michelle Williams' character, Dolores, needed help. She needed help, but they didn't get it for her because, you know, there was probably still that stigma around that, like, oh, someone talking to a therapist. And you still see it today, but, like, oh, someone talking to a therapist.
There's that, but there's also the fact that, I mean, even for him, there's another layer to it as well, because for him, when she needed help, and when it was clear that she needed help, she burned down their old apartment, and what does he do? He just turns to booze. He doesn't try to get her help, and
I'm not convinced, start folding in
the concentration camp stuff here, because is he, you know, just haunted by these demons? There's also a very, very huge subtext of post-traumatic stress disorder in this film as well, which I also love, and I also think that plays a huge role in it, you know?
Well, I'm not convinced he wasn't drinking before then. You know, I see World War II, like, was. For instance, I'm just going to compare this to a Netflix movie. There is a Mudbound, the Netflix movie. One of the characters in the movie becomes a heavy alcoholic because he just kind of can't deal with it, how his situation was handled in World War II.
Right,
so he just becomes an alcoholic. So I'm not convinced that Leo's character wasn't self-medicating with alcohol in order to, you know, kind of figure out, like, okay, how can I fucking quiet this scene of this guy unsuccessfully killing himself, and just there being all this blood all over this place, and, you know, murdering all these Nazi camp, all these soldiers of this Nazi camp. Like, you know, despite the fact that they're fucking monsters for even being at this camp, it's still something meaningful. Like, there's still people. Like, despite how you want to portray them, there's still people. And killing somebody is it's still extremely hard to
watch, and that's why it's so effective. Any other thoughts you want to get in here on this film, Dan? Like I said, I love this film, and I love rewatching it a second time. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you about rearranging the structure of the film either. I think that the film works the way that it's structured. I just think that the film is one of those kinds of films that's meant to be viewed more than one time. It's meant to go back and give it a revisit, because the film becomes so much more tragic when you know that Teddy is latest. When you know everything that's going on, it becomes heartbreaking in a way, because all these people want to do is just help him. All these people want to do is help him have a breakthrough so he can try to get something in his life, so he can try to get past the things that have haunted him and past what he did. And unfortunately, they're never able to do that. And it's even more heartbreaking, like I said, on multiple rewatches. That's why I really do enjoy the film. You know, you can argue forever about whether the twist was good, whether the twist was bad. I got the twist right away. I didn't get the twist right away. Who cares?
Well, I mean, that's just regular zeitgeist. It's like, hey, guys, I want to look smart, so I got this twist. Did you get it? Did you know? Yeah. Did you know that he was the patient the whole time?
Which I hate it when people do that whenever there's a twist in any film. Oh, I got it right away. And?
Okay, I hated the movie since, and it's like, oh.
Because the whole point of the film, the whole point of any twist in any film, isn't whether or not you get it. That's not the point. The whole point is how well does it play thematically, and how well does it play, you know, in terms of the characters in the story? Does it make sense for the characters in the story? And what does it change about what you know about the characters in the story? And for this film, like I said, I think it twists this and
changes
a much
everything.
More tragic tale. Yeah,
it takes
everything.
It takes
You're right.
What you find to be like, this is a crime drama. And then all of a sudden it becomes like, and I don't really have a good genre for it, but all of a sudden it turns on its head and becomes like this sympathy piece. It's like,
yeah,
holy shit, this man is so fucking damaged that we
it's
had to
tragic,
go to
it really
these
is.
Extreme lengths in order to help him, in order to help him cope, in order to help him become, you know, a regular person again.
Yeah. And I'm not here to comment on, you know, the state of mental health at the time or even nowadays or whatever the case may be. But like, I love the fact that they're willing to stage this. If you think about how intricate and elaborate this entire thing has to be, how crazy this whole thing has to be for him, you know, for them to put all this on to try to save him. I mean, really, in reality, that's what they're trying to do is save him, because unfortunately, he's violent. He's prone to outbursts. He's got military training, so it's very, very dangerous. He beat the shit out of Jackie Earl Haley's character. That's why he's locked away in Ward C, you know, because not only is he a little off kilter, but, you know, he's also there kind of for his own protection as well. And I think it that's why I love it so much. And that's why, like I said, it becomes so much more tragic when all they're trying to do is save him. And the fact that they did this entire thing, it would have been so easy for them to just dope him up or give him electroshock or give him a lobotomy and just call it a day. But they try everything they can to save this character. They really try everything that they can. And unfortunately, it's all for naught.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of bring up like a couple more standout moments like that are kind of like, oh, this, there's something not right about this. I'm not understanding why this is like, for instance, when they get off the boat and you just see all those guards with guns and you're just like, man, why are they so on edge? And then like,
they have like
review,
an almost militarized police force on the island.
Yeah. And you're just like, and then all of a sudden it's like when you watch it on the second view, you're like, oh, that makes way more sense. Like Leo's even like, man, guys, you need to calm the fuck down. And it's like, oh no. No, you should not calm the fuck down. Like, this guy is crazy. Like, it really is just a tragic story of a man. It's really all it comes down to.
Yeah, it really is. Final rating, Dan? Final rating, what would you stamp on this guy?
8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm right in lockstep with you. 8 out of 10. Woo! It's a really, really good film. It's really, really good. It's not like a masterpiece or anything, and I definitely don't think it's Scorsese's best. But, you know, I'd probably have a hard time saying it's his worst either, you know. But either way, check out the film if you never have. I don't know why you listened all the way through this and did that.
Ashley, you're watching again. I don't care what you say.
Ashley, we love you. Stream, we love you. Thank you very much, everybody in stream, for joining us. Who wants to give away some EFG stickers? Anybody want some stickers over in stream? The winner of 3 Epic Film Guys stickers my best friend from our episode on Glee and Arrested Development. And even though she broke my heart with Lost, I still love her to death. Ashley, congratulations. You have won 3 Epic Film Guy stickers. You'll have to send me your address over in Facebook or wherever else. And you win 3 Epic Film Guy stickers. They're right here in this envelope.
I'm going to be real nervous if she ever wins, like, for our shirt. Because it's like, oh, well, that's not legit. Like, even though it's totally legit because it's fucking random. Like, I swear to God, it's fucking random. But, yeah, I'm going to be spooked if she wins.
All right. And, well, that'll do it. But first, I want to thank you, Dan, for joining me to talk about Shutter Island.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for being here.
I'm so happy to have you as my best friend.
You can find both of us as part of the Podfix Network. Check that out at podfixnetwork.com. I mean, you could just search for Epic Film Guys, search for Netflix and Swill. You're going to find us if you Google us.
Or everywhere. You can go to the all-new netflixandswill.com.
That's right.
Where I post Netflix and Swill, or Netflix and Swill news. I just post Netflix news over there sometimes.
Post Netflix and Swill news.
Yeah, and there's one story I haven't touched yet. It's that House of Cards season 6 has resumed production, and it's just like I have no idea how to write this story because it's just like I don't. I kind of feel like I have to mention what's this fuck, but I don't want to mention what's
Kevin Spacey's like outside of a chain link fence, like outside of the perimeter of the set, like peering in, trying to see what they're doing.
Guys, please don't fuck this up.
Oh my god! But yes. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. We're going to go ahead and roll out into the stream here again. Please go ahead and join Caleb over there. Find us all on social media. Epic Film Guys, Netflix and Swill. We love you. Thank you very, very much. And we'll see you next Tuesday at the movies. Sorry. Woo! Wait. Shit. I didn't know where the hell I was. Thank you very much, everybody. We love you.
Check out more shows like it at PodfixNetwork.com.